We've been hearing a lot about the term fake news lately, but what exactly is fake news? Well, we're going to hear from someone who can help us understand it in this episode of The Spirit of Leading. I'm Garland McWaters. My guest on this episode of The Spirit of Leading is Wayne Green. Wayne is the editorial page editor of the Tulsa World newspaper. Wayne, thanks so much for taking time to give us your point of view of this particularly important subject today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Garland.
Well, Wayne, you've been in the journalism business your entire career. You started kind of as a young reporter in Enid and moved to Tulsa shortly after that and have worked your way up to your current position. And thinking back on those early days, what was it like being a reporter for the first time in a local newspaper?
Oh, it's great fun. I started off as a reporter, as you mentioned, at the Enid Morning News 31 years ago. It was locally owned. We had a good, solid news team working in our newsroom, and we just worked our butts off every day trying to keep the people of Garfield County informed about what they needed to know to do business and live life in Northwest Oklahoma. It was a great place to start, and it was a great training ground for bigger things.
I imagine when you're in a smaller market newspaper, you kind of just cover everything. If it's moving, it's news.
Well, I was technically the business writer, which meant once a week on Wednesday, I wrote a feature story about a local business. It also meant that it was my job to go down to the courthouse at the end of the day every day and gather the property transactions with all the meets and bounds on them, and then retype those. That was extraordinarily difficult to retype that in an accurate fashion because it's all in jargon that no one understands.
Well, it was a paper of record, I guess.
It was a paper of record, right. And someone else's job was to pick up the divorces. Another person picked up the civil filings and what have you. At any rate, for the most part, I was a general assignment reporter who carried the title of business reporter. But then after I'd been there about 2 months, the largest bank in town, the one that was called First National Bank of Enid, was closed by the FDIC. And the rest of my not really long career in Enid was spent covering the aftershocks of this horrible economic news, and I spent the rest of my career there trying to figure out what it meant for Enid that we'd lost First National Bank.
Well, I'm sure it was devastating, and there was probably a lot of stories that came out of that. Yeah. We hear about newspapers, and we see newspapers portrayed in movies and in various other ways. But that doesn't give us a lot of insight as to maybe how a paper actually functions. And so how is the Tulsa World and papers like the Tulsa World sort of organize or structure? How does it kind of work on the inside?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the image you get on television is a little bit, and in movies it's a little bit romanticized. And there are a lot more days that you're writing stories about dog shows and veterans parades than days that you're chasing serial killers or the governor down. Although there are days that you're chasing serial killers and governors. So the organization, if you look at the organization of your morning paper, you'd have a sense of the organization of the operation. You have a series of sections which relate to editors. So you have a business section and a business editor, a sports section, a sports editor, a local section and a local editor, known as the city editor. And each one of those editors have a staff who are generally dedicated to specific beats. So on our city desk, I was the city editor for about 13 years of my career here at the Tulsa World. Yeah, I had reporters who were covering specific elements of state of government. So when people who were covering the state capitol, at the time, we had a guy in Washington, D.C. covering our congressional delegation. We have someone at City Hall, someone covering county government. So various beats, and then non-government beats. You'd have someone who's covering social services and health. You'd have someone who's covering the school board, of course, and things like that. Now, the superstructure over all those section editors would be the lead man of sort of coordinating the city desk and the business desk and the sports desk and the copy desk would be the managing editor, and then the chief executive is the executive editor, and they kind of split up the executive functions of the newsroom. Now, I'm the editorial pages editor. By tradition in the newspaper business, the editorial page editor and the executive editor, or in older newspapers, they would just call that person the editor, are the two people who have direct reporting lines to the publisher. And that's an important, that's by design. In a sense, we're co-equals, although it's an unequal situation. Our executive editor has, by rights, has more people and more money and more...
Right.
Space in the paper, and that's as it should be, of course. But we both report to the publisher because the news department does not dictate what the opinions of the paper are going to be, mm-hmm. and the opinion section doesn't dictate how they're going to handle the news coverage. We're of course both interested observers in each other's work and very much dependent on each other. We're it's not an adversarial relationship at all. We're great old friends. It is an important element in making sure that that we can tell the public honestly that we don't change our opinions to benefit our news section, and more importantly, that the news reporters aren't responsible for the opinions right. that are expressed on my opinion pages. And then, you know, above our heads, the publisher is the point where everything comes together. He's the chief executive officer of the newspaper. So advertising and classified advertising and the physical plant of the paper, all of that comes together at his level.
Let's go back into some of these distinctions too, because before we get off of the news side of it, I wanted to, and going reflecting back on your career as a city desk editor and a reporter yourself, what makes news news? I mean, who decides what the news is? Right. And when we talk about the news, I mean, that sort of stands for something. Right. What does that stand for in your mind?
You know, that's an interesting question because I think we're witnessing a change. We're watching that change. It used to be news is what somebody said it was. It's like when I was in a class in economics, the professor said, "What is money? Money is something that people accept as money," mm-hmm. Which could be a shell, it could be currency, it could be all sorts of things. Well, that's news is what's perceived to be news, which is I apologize for having given you a circular answer to it, but it used to be that there were gatekeepers, editors who had news judgment standards, which are important things, and they would just make decisions on that basis of what is and what isn't news. So that as a national news consumer, you would watch a presidential press conference and you'd see 100 people in there, but if you actually analyzed it, what you'd find is that the television stations, the radio stations, and most of the newspapers were following the lead of one or two mm-hmm. News operations, the New York Times and the Washington Post. Really, the New York Times was defining what is news on a national level. That's still very, very true. If a story appears in the New York Times, you can count on it appearing in Time magazine and all those other organs shortly thereafter. And then if you go to the New York Times and do some analysis, you'd find that's actually a fairly small number of people at the New York Times who were defining what news is. And that was equally true on a local level. You know, the Tulsa World was the dominant media organization, and it still is, in northeastern Oklahoma. So if the city editor decided that this is news and put it on his front page, there's a pretty good chance that the next day, back in the day when we had three television stations doing local news, those three television stations would follow that lead, and so would the local radio station. We had a gatekeeper who was getting to define that. Now the internet has changed that in a lot of ways, and for one thing, it's made us broaden and sort of vary some of those judgments that we've always had. I can give you a very specific example. When I was a city editor, I remember our chief photographer at the time brought a picture to the executive editor of it was a very good picture of a traffic jam, traffic back up to the horizon on the Broken Arrow Expressway. And the executive editor said, "Well, what happened?" And he said, "Well, someone had a wreck and it blocked traffic." And the executive editor said, "I don't think I want to use that." And the photographer said, "Well, why not?" And he said, "Well, we're not a traffic accident newspaper." So he was using his news judgment. Well, I can guarantee you that if we have a story now about traffic being backed up to the horizon, that is going on our website, because we can very specifically tell you at any time on our website how many people are reading this story and how long they're reading it. And traffic jam stories sell. People want to read that. If you put a story on the Tulsa World website that says, traffic blocked on Broken Arrow Expressway, you can guarantee thousands of people will read that, wanting to know where the accident is, how long it's going to be before it's backed up, am I going to be able to get home in less than 2 hours. Similarly, when I was a city editor, I had a rule of thumb that we did not write stories about bomb threats. We wrote stories about bombs. So if the police came on the radio, we listened to the police scanner, of course, and said that they were investigating a bomb threat at XYZ school, you'd hustle a reporter out there to keep an eye on it. And if after 4 hours or however long it takes, a very long time, the public information officer came out and said, "Nope, no bomb. We're sending the kids mm-hmm. back into the school," we wouldn't do anything with it. But because the argument we had gotten for years from the school system was, if you publish stories about bomb threats, it's going to encourage kids to make bomb threats. Mm-hmm. But then sometime after that happened, you put a bomb threat story on the website, and you can find out that hundreds and hundreds of people will want to read that story. They're defining what the news is, right, not us. Because they want to know what school it is, how legitimate is the threat, what are they doing, do I need to go pick up my children? There's a lot of legitimate questions that news consumers have there. And so we are in a process that's redefining what is and isn't news right now.
Well, inquiring minds want to know.
Yes.
And go back to the traffic jam, for example.
Right.
If you say, well, there's a traffic jam, but then you find out the traffic jam was caused by road rage, that kind of makes that story a little more,
well, it's sexier,
interesting.
Right.
Yeah,
it's strange. While road rage is topical, what people really want to know about is how bad is the traffic and
right.
how long is it going to be that way.
Right.
I mean, there's just no other word for it. We used to be much more arrogant about how we drew lines in what is and isn't news. And the internet is teaching us that we really can't be.
Right. Well, there's the, I guess, the old adage of what's significant. What do people need to know about that's going to impact their lives?
Right.
And are our news outlets covering that information, although it might not be sensational, it's definitely important to their lives. And how do you make those kinds of judgments? What really is significant that people should know about?
Yeah.
That if we didn't take the time to tell them and take the time to cover them, they would probably never hear about it.
Well, the internet is a remarkable tool for judging that. I mean, we used to make judgments because we just thought we knew it, and it was, there were a lot of, some of that was wisdom that was handed down from editor to editor, and some of that was things that we had picked up from conversations with police chiefs and superintendents, and there was a whole thousands of different vectors that went into that force. But now we have essentially an undeniable way of testing it. Do people want to read this? Well, let's put it on the website and see what happens. And it's sometimes a little disconcerting, because the things that we thought people wanted to read, that it turns out they weren't always that interested mm-hmm. in reading. And the things that we thought no one would want to read this, people are fascinated with.
So it's an interesting balance of trying to find what people want to know about and what they need to know about, what's the responsibility to cover those things that are important to them. Like you might be thinking about the way city government functions or other kinds of things that might be going on. And if the media were not making them aware of some of those situations, they would probably just be loping along in sort of sensational bliss of other things that
you make a good point there. You know, I used to have an editor who would refer to stories occasionally that we do as important but dull stories.
Yes, well, probably so. Yes.
Yeah, we explanations of how ad valorem taxes are figured, incredibly important, but very difficult to write in a readable fashion. I'll admit we're still committed to writing those kinds of stories. Our news department is still committed to writing those kinds of stories, and you know sometimes we have moved them into the editorial section. Because we have a little bit more leisure to do explanatory journalism. But we are finding that, frankly, not only did we find them dull, but our readers were finding them dull, and they're not turning to those stories, and they're not engaged in them very actively after they get to them.
So probably a different conversation. It makes for a very interesting perspective, though, because if the people aren't really interested in what's going on in their own community that affects them, how do you become an informed individual to make those decisions?
They are interested in what's going on in the community. It's just different aspects of it than we had always assumed.
Yeah.
We always were, and to a certain extent still very much continue to be, newspapers are public policy, or about public writing about public policy, but it turns out that readers have a much more diverse interests than things that are going on at City Hall and at the county courthouse, and you know there are still junkies out there who very much want to know every twist and turn, especially in the legislative process. But we're having to at least broaden some of our thinking on that.
Let me go back to my original comment at the beginning of the program about fake news. Just the concept of the term fake news conjures up a lot of things in my mind that probably ought to be explored. As an editor and as a reporter yourself in the past, what is fake news in your mind from what we're hearing as that term is being used?
Fake news is news that's, I'm sorry, another circular definition. It's news that's fake, and it's produced with fraudulent intent. There's no intent to inform with people about what's happened. It's usually for some political purpose or some social purpose. It's just wholly contrived, put out as if it were real through the internet, typically. To my knowledge, only through the internet. The example that is consistently cited is that during the Clinton-Trump campaign, there was a story produced about a pizza restaurant in Washington, D.C., that was somehow tied to the Clinton campaign, and that was supposedly a front for all sorts of unbelievably cruel crimes against children. No truth at all to that, but it so affected at least one reader that he came to Washington from out of state with a gun and started to shoot the place up because he really believed what he had read online. It is easy to be fooled by things you read if you're not a savvy reader on the internet. Now, often people use the word fake news to mean things that they don't believe or they just don't want to believe, things that they're in denial about. It's a pejorative that gets thrown around rather lightly without any sort of evidence of fakeness.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea because at what point, where do you draw the line? Because I have kind of some interest in background in like public relations and things like that, and I was always asked to tell a story a certain way, not to really lie, but to tell a story in a certain kind of light, to make my client's best interest, right, you know, shine a little bit more.
Right.
And so, is that necessarily fake? And it wasn't just made up, but it was just sort of told with a certain angle to it, you know, or you tell certain things and you don't tell other things. where do we start to cross the line between something that is just totally fabricated and something that is only slightly tweaked, but it still is, misleads a little bit or doesn't tell the whole story?
That's an interesting ethical question. I mean, and I think a lot of it has to do with intent. If the intent is to deceive, whether that's biased news or fake news or whatever, it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The intention of a reporter should always be to inform. And, you know, one of the reasons why professional reporters are still of value is that they're trained to recognize and confront their own predilections, their own biases, and to make sure that does not bleed into their coverage. That is a hard-learned talent, and it takes a special person to be able to do it. So I think that's one of the reasons why there's still a value for professional journalism.
Right, there's sort of the concept of, I've heard in the past, of like a journalistic integrity. It's sort of the suggesting an ethic that journalists hold their role and responsibility such a high regard that you know, they kind of, in a sense, sign their work, if they have a byline, for example, right, and or writing a column. But if you're reporting something, you want to go out and tell the complete story as best you can, and tell it in a way that, as you said earlier, informs and gives a context to what that information means, and to distort that in some way for some bias that you might have would certainly violate that concept.
You're right. I mean, the most important asset that any reporter and any news organization in the Tulsa World has is their integrity. I mean, that's more valuable than the building, the paper, the presses, you know, all the assets on the balance sheet. The city's, the community's willingness to believe what we say is so much more valuable than all
right,
that other stuff.
Right. Let's talk about the profession itself. And I know there's a lot of interest today from young people wanting to be part of the journalism profession or to do a blog or do something that is a part of this public information industry. What advice would you give to young people who are thinking about jumping off and looking at journalism as a profession?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you want to work in the newspaper business, and I think there's still careers to be had in the newspaper business, you need to go to college and spend as much time as you can while getting that education in the operation of, in the cooperative effort that is your daily college newspaper. If you're not at a college that has a daily newspaper, you've not gone to the right to the right college. When you go to apply for your first job, what you want to be able to show the editor is, here's the story I wrote on Monday, here's the story I followed it up on with Tuesday, Wednesday I had this follow-up, and then Thursday we wrapped it up with this. Whether that's online or in print, what's important is to show that you dealt with a challenging story in a professional fashion. One of the reasons I was attracted to the business was when I first walked into the newsroom of the newspaper at the University of Oklahoma, the Oklahoma Daily. There was a crew of bright, engaged. It was the smartest group of people I met in college. You know, we might be working on stories about, the sports department on the football team, and in news we might have been writing about whatever the regents or the student government were doing, but the conversations across the copy desk, might be about German philosophy, and you would not have a better conversation about German philosophy in a German philosophy class at the university. In that day, journalism was attracting the smartest, most mentally aggressive people on college campuses, and that's what was attractive about it to me, and that's what makes for great reporters.
And I know there are a lot of young people who have some of that same desire to be engaged with a group of people who really are bright and intelligent and informed and have a scope and a perspective of what's going on in the world and around them and what's meaningful and important, and to affect that in some way. to either know it and then to be able to do something with that information. And I can think of so many young people getting involved in community causes and in volunteer efforts, which sort of speaks to that sort of mindset and that eagerness, you know, to make a difference. A question here that I wanted to kind of just back up for a second and pursue a little bit. The real difference between editorial, your editorial and opinion side, mm-hmm. and the news side. Why is it important to have those two separate? And secondly, how does that serve as a model for other forms of media, such as broadcast or cable news and things like that, and even comedy? I mean, you listen to someone like Jon Stewart or other comedians who have a very definite political mm-hmm. perspectives, you know, and they say, "Don't come to us for news. We're not news people.
Right.
We're entertainers."
Right.
And so there's kind of all that gets mingled up a little bit.
Right.
What would you say to people about the difference between
right.
opinion and just reporting?
Right. Well, that's an incredibly important question to me, and I'm glad you brought it back up. Newspapers in the United States are very careful about dividing their opinion sections, editorial and op-ed pages, from their news operations for a lot of reasons. It's practical reasons in terms of reporters shouldn't have to answer for editorials, and editorial writers don't have to answer for what reporters are doing. It's also, there's a marketing element to that. The newspaper wants to appeal to the big middle of the market. To do that, they have to honestly be able to tell readers of all political stripes that our news coverage is independent and free of bias, as free of bias as we can make it. Now that is unique in the United States, and it's unique in current history, quite frankly. In the 18th century, American newspapers were organs of political parties. That's why some of them still have the word Democrat or Republican on their masthead, because they used to be the organ of the Democratic Party in that place, or the Republican Party. That is still true in much of Europe, in Canada, and you have a very different style of journalism there. There is a lot more freelance editorializing going on in the what we would think of as the place for objective news reporting. That's not the way that we do it in the United States for the most part, and that's not how we do it at the Tulsa World. We mark opinion pieces as opinion pieces, which means they represent the opinion of either the signed author or of the newspaper corporately, in the case of unsigned editorials. But those are distinct from stories that are written by our reporters, which should reflect nobody's opinion. They should reflect only the facts as they happened.
Very well said. And I guess that probably goes to what I would say would be advice to just about everybody who is a consumer of the media, to look at the newspapers particularly, who have been sort of institutionally the stalwarts, I guess, of keeping those two elements separate, the reporting versus the opinion, and look at them as sort of I would call the legitimate press in a sense, and realize that other people have the right to express opinions, but you have to realize that much of what they're saying or opinions that goes like cable news. It goes for blogging. It goes for a lot of other sort of organs that might look legitimate or look institutional, but at the same time, they really just simply are a PR arm of a particular point of view.
Right, and it's important to point out, you know, it's very expensive to have reporters who are out gathering information and reporting it. So the people who are just in it for the opinion element of it don't invest in that. They are actually bringing you a set of facts, as much as there are facts involved in what they're presenting, that they've gleaned from legitimate news on the national level. An awful lot of the things that you'll hear on cable TV or certainly read on the internet at some point date back, can be traced back to either the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Associated Press or a handful of other news gathering organizations. And locally, you know, most information eventually trails back to the Tulsa World, or perhaps one of the three or four TV stations.
Right. Opinions are things that are just people spin on things. That's the way they see it, perceive it, or want to tell a story.
Right.
As it goes to facts, opinions are not factual. They may be based on information or facts, but they are a spin on facts.
Right.
And for that reason, opinions are neither right nor wrong. They're just agreed with or not.
Well, they're neither right nor wrong, but you can certainly make value judgments about opinions. I mean, they can be valid or invalid.
Right, yes.
And they can be well-reasoned and argued. I mean, we try in our opinion sections to keep our opinions coherent and consistent over time, consistent with each other, so that we use the same standards for judging a set of facts today as we would have used 4 years ago or 8 years ago or 4 years from now. And sometimes we'll say in opinions, attention Democrats or attention Republicans, you really don't want to take this step because 4 years from now, when you're the governor or president, you might not want to be treated the same way, and the same standards should apply over time. So there are such things as good opinions and bad opinions, but there are often multiple good opinions.
Yes.
And there are an infinite number of bad opinions.
I'm glad you brought that up, because when I'm engaged in a conversation with someone, they're presenting their spin or their opinion on something. The thing I want to go back to is, okay, well, how did you get to that?
Mm-hmm.
I might not really agree with it, but what was your reasoning? What facts are they based on? What reasoning strategy are you using to come to formulate that particular opinion? And if people can sort of explain to me why they're thinking, I go, oh, okay, well, I'll think about that.
Right.
And so I'm willing to accept that opinion as a legitimate possibility, and then I can put that into my own processing. And I think, well, maybe I need to change my mind
right.
about that,
right.
because that really makes a good point.
But that does kind of point to how important it is to have a reliable set of facts.
So, yes.
So that if there are pernicious people out there who are intentionally promoting fraudulent facts, that's really, really corrosive to our society.
And I think that's why it's so important to have institutions that are respected for really separating those and are very, very, very diligent about seeking out the facts and the context of the facts and things of that nature. It gives us a place to go to know, okay, well, I can really trust that really happened as reported, or that's really true about that event, or about what that person said, or about what their intentions were, mm-hmm. or what they expressed. Because that gives us a good place to work from to really understand our communities.
I couldn't agree
so
with
forth.
You more.
I think it's a topic that's certainly relevant to the context of the spirit of leading, because leaders who lead with a spirit of leading are looking for the best information they can find to make the best decisions they can make to help people move forward in ways that are going to be to the benefit of as many as possible. And good leaders, I think, across the board, regardless of their political point of view, are devoted to that kind of approach. And they're not just misleading people for personal gain or political gain, but they really are sincerely trying to make things better. And I appreciate your taking time to give us your perspective from having been behind the desk and on the beat, and have a very refined perspective of kind of how those things fit together and why they are so important. Because, you know, constitutionally, in our Bill of Rights, the First Amendment, freedom of the press, mm-hmm. a viable, vibrant freedom of the press. And I certainly agree that that as Americans, that everybody gets to say what they want to say. And it should not be refrained from saying what they want to say. But we have to have some way of really putting that in some context and understanding it.
You know, painted on the wall of our editorial board conference room is a quote from Thomas Jefferson. In essence, what it says is that because a factual basis is the foundation for our government, for a democratic government, if given choice between a government without newspapers or newspapers without government, he wouldn't hesitate to choose newspapers over government.
Well, it speaks to the importance of it and what it means to live in the kind of country that we do, where we can have a press that we can believe in and have confidence in, that it's really helping us understand our world better. Wayne Green, thank you so much for
it's been a
your
pleasure.
Perspectives and best wishes for you and your Tulsa World as you continue your career here as Tulsa World continues to be a paper of influence in this part of the country.
Thank you for your interest and thank you for your time.
You bet. Wayne Green, the editorial page editor of the Tulsa World, my guest today on The Spirit of Leading. Well, that's it for this episode of the Spirit of Leading podcast. So until next time, I encourage you to live each and every day empowered. I'm Garland McWaters, and I encourage you to encourage the spirit, to enliven the heart, to enlighten the mind, and to enlarge the expectations of living in yourself and in others.